Right, this is now talk 11 in the Galatians series. We're getting close to the end now, and what I'm doing at the moment, and have been for the last week or two, is looking at things outside of the letter to the Galatians, which confirm, corroborate, explain, amplify what Paul was saying in Galatians, and also dealing with this point which I want to make very clear, which is that the points made in Galatians are not made only in Galatians. It's not just something that's unique to Galatians, and the rest of the Bible says nothing along these lines. The rest of the Bible is wholly consistent with Galatians. So we're going to be going all over the place, and for that reason I'll do the readings myself. But what I'll also do is sometimes just read out the reference without reading it all out, and make the point that's contained within it, because otherwise it would take too long. And I'm going to go to quite a lot of passages. So let's begin then with in Philippians. And here we see Paul giving some very blunt words about what he calls, what we have come to know as the circumcision party. And so this is how Paul speaks of them in Philippians chapter 3, verse 2. And 3. And he says, look out for the dogs. Look out for the evil workers. Look out for those who mutilate the flesh. For we are the true circumcision, who worship God in spirit and glory in Christ Jesus, and put no confidence in the flesh. Now, my point is this. That's how strongly Paul felt. So he wasn't beating about the bush or using mealy-mouthed words or skirting around the issue. That is how he described this group, the circumcision party, and what is it that they said and did? Well, they were advocating that Gentiles in particular should be circumcised in order to become Christians, that it's a necessary part of being a Christian, and obeying the law is a necessary part of being Christian, and that circumcision was an emblem that stood for all that, represented all of that. So Paul doesn't just say, well, actually, I don't share that view. Well, that's not my perspective. He's very strong in the things he says. And I'm drawing attention to that in order to address the reluctance that some people have to think that Paul could really be saying and meaning what he seems to be saying and meaning. So, let's look also briefly, don't be looking these verses up because you'll be jumping about too much, but in 1 Timothy 1, verses 8 to 11, here's Paul speaking again about the law, and he's speaking here about what the law was useful for. What is its purpose? Remember, I described the law as a thermometer, just to tell you that you've got a temperature, not to make you well. In verses 8 to 11, Paul says, now we know that the law is good, if anyone uses it lawfully, understanding this, that the law is not laid down for the just, but for the lawless and disobedient, for the ungodly and sinners, for the unholy and profane, for murderers of fathers and murderers of mothers, for manslayers, immoral persons, sodomites, kidnappers, liars, perjurers, and whatever else is contrary to sound doctrine, in accordance with the glorious gospel of the blessed God with which I have been entrusted. So, if you feel you come into those categories, then the law is for you, if you are those things. But what is he meaning? The law is there to tell people of those types, namely everybody, what they are. The law is there to tell you what you are. That's what it's there for, to show you what you are. To show you that you're sinners, to show you that you are these things. And we've already heard in previous talks that nobody's ever kept the law. We've already seen that nobody ever can keep the law. So that's who it's for. It's to show you that you are those things. Well, we know that we are those things. So, Colossians chapter 2, verse 16, Paul says, therefore, let no one pass judgment on you in questions of food and drink, or with regard to a festival, or a new moon, or a Sabbath. And we've seen last week, when I spoke last week, Paul was saying very similar things. Now that verse cannot be said if the law of Moses is currently in operation. You can't say that and at the same time have the law of Moses in operation. It simply can't be. Because the two are at variance. So when we speak of the food and drink, what are we talking of here? The kosher rules, the food rules that are set out within the law of Moses. Okay? What are we talking about? The festivals, the Sabbath? The rules that are set out within the law of Moses about those things. So what is Paul saying here? Let no one pass judgment on you in questions of these things. He's saying, nobody can tell you that you're right or wrong by reference to what you eat, the festivals you keep or don't keep, the things you do or don't eat, the keeping or not keeping of the Sabbath, the day which you choose for a Sabbath, whether you do anything on a Saturday or a Sunday or whatever. All of that is up to yourself. Now, you simply can't say that verse if the law is in operation, because if it's too long to look at. If you looked at the whole of Leviticus chapter 11, just for example, that whole chapter tells you a whole bunch of things that are unclean. Well, either Moses is still in operation, in which case Paul is wrong, or Paul is right, in which case what Moses says in Leviticus chapter 11 is no longer in operation. You cannot have both, do you see? And what that may sound obvious, but it's the point. It's the point that isn't being grasped by those who believe that we're under the law. You can't have the law and have Paul's letter to the Colossians. You've either got to remove Colossians from the Bible, or you've got to remove your idea that you're under the law, because you can't have both. But whilst you're about it, you'll need to remove Philippians, Galatians, Titus, and just about all Paul's letters, and pretty much you're going to have to get rid of Acts and Peter's letters, and you're going to have to get rid of James, and you're going to have to get rid of pretty much everything if you want to retain the law of Moses in operation. Do you see? That's the reality of the situation. Okay, so what does Paul say in Titus? Titus chapter 1, verses 10 to 11. He says, "For there are many insubordinate men, empty talkers and deceivers, especially the circumcision party. They must be silenced, since they are upsetting whole families by teaching for base gain what they have no right to teach." So he's also drawing attention to the fact that in his view they're in it for money. They're doing this for gain. But the principal point is that their message is wrong. They have no right to tell you that you're under the law, because you're not. And again, in case anybody's under any doubts as to how strongly Paul feels about it, look at the words he uses to describe them. Insubordinate men, empty talkers, deceivers. Now, that's not the language you use when you have a mild difference of view in a kind of nuanced fashion about someone's interpretation of a complicated point. You don't say that to them, do you? If someone has a different opinion than you about where we should precisely fix interest rates at the moment, you don't call them those things, do you? And so what Paul is saying is not, I have a mild difference of view with these people. He's saying, I totally, absolutely disagree with them. They're absolutely wrong. And it's important to recognise that. And not to think that if you believe in the law, your only opponent is Paul's letter to the Galatians, and if you can kind of explain that away, you no longer face any opposition. Your views no longer face any opposition within the New Testament, because they are opposed by the whole New Testament, more or less. Now let me move on to another issue now, and this is priesthood. The Levitical priesthood, the Melchizedek priesthood, and Jesus' priesthood, and all of these issues, because these are complicated issues which very few people actually understand. But if we understand what's meant by all this business about priesthood, well, first of all, we'll have gained an understanding of that. But secondly, we will have another issue that requires the law of Moses to be at an end. So what I'm attempting to do in these latter talks is to give you 101 different additional reasons why the law of Moses must be at an end. And here's another. Now, we're talking now from Hebrews. Now, I think Paul wrote Hebrews, but whoever wrote Hebrews, the point is it's in the New Testament. To me, it's very likely to be Paul. And there are very good reasons why Paul left his name off it, because he wasn't exactly Mr. Popular. And he was writing the letter to the Hebrews, to the Jewish people, and he wasn't popular with the Jewish people particularly. And so it's not surprising that he'd leave his name off that letter. But if you look at the style and even the endings of the letter to the Hebrews, it's just like Paul's style. All his different, his username and the way he tweets in that letter, it's just his style. His style. But anyway, be that as it may, here's what he's saying in chapter 7, 11 and 12, okay? He says, "Now, if perfection had been attainable through the Levitical priesthood, brackets, for under it the people received the law, close brackets, what further need would there have been for another priest to arise after the order of Melchizedek, rather than one named after the order of Aaron? Question mark. For when there is a change in the priesthood, there is necessarily a change in the law as well." Now, what on earth is that about? Does anyone know what that all means? What's Paul talking? Well, what's the writer of the letter to the Hebrews talking about here? What he's saying is that there has been a change. There has been a change in the Levitical priesthood, and that change has been necessary. The change in the Levitical priesthood has brought about a necessary change in the law. So what are we saying? This is what we're saying. Under the law of Moses, only certain people could be priests. Now, what did you have to be a priest? You had to be from the tribe of Levi to start with, but you also had to be a descendant of Aaron, because Aaron had four sons, Nadab and Abihu, were put to death by God because of their sin, but the other two survived, and from them came the priesthood. So to be a priest, a Levitical priest, you had to be descended from Aaron. There's no question about it. That's just the fact. That's just the way it is. Okay, now that creates a problem, because Jesus purports to be a priest. He's our high priest, isn't he? Now, Jesus, we've already seen, totally observed the law of Moses during his earthly ministry. But now, he was never a priest during his earthly ministry. Have you noticed that? He never ever operated as a priest. He never went into the temple as a priest. He went into the temple as a member of the community. He was a part of the tribe of Judah and had no right to be a priest in the temple. That right belonged only to the family members of Aaron. So he couldn't do that. Now, we're going to see in subsequent passages I'm going to go through that Jesus is now functioning as a priest. That's been his ministry for the last nearly 2,000 years. So what's he doing? He's our go-between at present, between God and us. He's our advocate in front of God. He's our priest. He goes into the holy place. He's our high priest. Now, we ourselves are also priests, because we can approach God now. We've got no right to do that under the law of Moses, because we're not descendants of Aaron. We're not even in the tribe of Levi, never mind the family members of Aaron. So we can't operate as priests. We can't have direct access to God under the law of Moses either. But be that as it may, let's focus just on Jesus. He can't be the high priest or any kind of priest if the law of Moses is still in operation. But he says that he is a priest. So who's getting this wrong? Now, he says, not only does he say he's a priest, but he actually specifies the kind of priest that he is. And he's a priest after the order of Melchizedek. Now, the order of Melchizedek predates the law of Moses. Melchizedek was the man that Abraham met and to whom he gave a tithe and so forth and so on. Now, without getting into all this, many take the view that Melchizedek was Jesus in a pre-appearance. Whether he was or wasn't, there are many reasons to think that he was. But whether he was or wasn't, the point is this: Melchizedek was not of the tribe of Levi, because there wasn't a tribe of Levi centuries before Levi even existed. And Melchizedek was operating as a priest, and what Jesus is doing now is operating as a priest, not under the law of Moses, but in like fashion to Melchizedek, who either was Jesus or is a type or representation of what Jesus would later do. So what does all this imply? It means that there has, at the very least, been a change in the law of Moses so as to permit a non-Levite and a non-member of the family of Aaron to serve as a priest, which was forbidden under the law of Moses. Now remember, we said the law of Moses is one complete package. It comes together like a big glass vase. Imagine a vase with very fine glass. You can't knock a bit out of that vase and still call it a vase. Do you see? It's one thing. It comes together. You can't hit it with a hammer and knock a bit out and still say this is the vase. It's not a vase and it's a broken thing now. It's not the vase. The law of Moses can't have bits taken out of it. If you took out of it that which pertains to the priesthood, you've taken out a huge part of it. Do you see? At any rate, the fact is you can't do that. So then you have this problem. But Jesus says he is operating as a priest. Is he therefore breaking the law of Moses? No, he's not breaking the law of Moses. How do we know that? Because he's sinless and perfect, and he would never break the law of Moses. What did he do? He said he came to fulfill and complete and end the law of Moses. He's not breaking it. It is completed. You see? Okay. So let's then go on. In Hebrews chapter 8, we're now looking at the nature and purpose of what's called a new covenant. Now, the new covenant, what is this? It's a thing that Jeremiah prophesied about back in Jeremiah 31, I think, Jeremiah chapter 31. And I won't read it all out, but Jeremiah prophesied the coming of this new covenant. We already know about the other covenants, the ones made with Adam and Noah and Abraham and Moses and so forth. But Jeremiah was saying that there was going to be a new covenant. Now that new covenant was not in operation while the law of Moses was in operation. But it came into operation when Jesus died. So the new covenant is what is now in operation. We are now operating under the new covenant, that which Jeremiah prophesied and which Jesus brought into being. And when did he bring it into being? He brought it into being when he died and not before. So we were not operating under the new covenant during Jesus' earthly ministry. It's very important to note this, because later I'm going to talk a little more about that. But when Jesus was in his earthly ministry, what was he operating under? The law of Moses. And this will solve a lot of confusion if you realize this. So when Jesus was in his earthly ministry, he was advocating, upholding, and endorsing, and totally endorsing the law of Moses. Why would he not endorse it? He was entirely keeping it. He's the one and only man that's ever kept it. So why would he not endorse it? He totally endorsed it. But he endorsed it because he was under it. But at his death, it ended, for reasons I've already dealt with. And at his death, there came into operation this thing called the New Covenant. Now, the New Covenant is inconsistent with the law of Moses. It's mutually exclusive from the law of Moses. It can't be in operation with or alongside or at the same time as the law of Moses. They are completely inconsistent, mutually exclusive things. When the one starts, the other must end. But let's look at this thing, the new covenant. And Hebrews chapter 8 describes it. It says, for he finds fault with them when he says, verse 8, the days will come, says the Lord, when I will establish a new covenant with the house of Israel. He's quoting Jeremiah. And with the house of Judah. Verse 9. Not like the covenant that I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt. He's talking about the law of Moses. For they did not continue in my covenant, the law of Moses. And so I paid no heed to them, says the Lord. Verse 10, this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says the Lord. I will put my laws into their minds and write them on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall not teach every one his fellow or every one his brother, saying, know the Lord, for all shall know me, from the least of them to the greatest. For I will be merciful towards their iniquities, and I will remember their sins no more. Okay? Now this is a key verse. He's talking now in verse 13 of Hebrews 8. In speaking of a new covenant, he treats the first as obsolete. And what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. So, the writer to Hebrews is saying that in speaking of a new covenant, he treats the first as obsolete. The first means the law of Moses. It doesn't mean the covenant made with Adam. It means the law. The first means the first in regard to these two that we're talking of. Moses and new. Moses is the first, new is the next one. You can't have both. When the new comes into operation, the first is obsolete. Do you see? And so, you know, a completely new status comes into being. It's like moving from being single to being married. When you're single, you're single. And when you're married, you're married. You can't be married but single. You can't be single but married. So on the moment when you become married, you cease to be one thing and become another thing. Do you see? You can't say, yeah, I'm married but I'm single. Or I'm single, yes, but I'm married though. If you said that to anyone, they'd think you were being absurd. So you can't say, I'm under the law of Moses, but I'm under the new covenant. No, that's like saying, I'm single, but I'm married. Those are inconsistent statements. You can't make both or claim to be both simultaneously. See? So, he speaks of the first as obsolete. So how can the Bible be any clearer? This is why I marvel at the need that I even had to make this series of talks. But I made this series of talks because I keep getting told on Twitter and so forth that we're under the law of Moses. Well, this is why I marvel. How much more clear can the Bible be? And it's completely explicit. And the word, by the way, used there for obsolete in Hebrews, because the Bible uses several Greek words. In case anybody's in any doubt, it does use different Greek words to make the point very clear and unmistakable. And this particular one in verse 13 is paleu, which means obsolete or worn out. Okay? And that's talking about the law of Moses. So, okay. In Hebrews 9, it goes on to describe, in the first 14 verses of Hebrews 9, aspects of the law of Moses. It says, now even the first covenant had regulations for worship and an earthly sanctuary. And then in the next 14 verses, it describes the activities taking place in the temple, in the holy place, and so forth. It goes through those, and it's talking about the law of Moses. Okay, and in the first nine verses, it does that. And then it says in verse 10, this is good, a good important verse. Hebrews 9, verse 10. But deal only with food and drink and various ablutions, regulations for the body imposed until the time of reformation. So these things that it's speaking of, that the law of Moses deals with in the first nine verses of Hebrews 9, it says that only until the time of reformation. Now, the point I'm seeking to establish is that the law of Moses had a shelf life. On the law of Moses, if you looked at the shelf life on the law of Moses in the supermarket, it would say to be sold until the death of Jesus. That's what it would say at the supermarket if you looked at the law of Moses. It had a shelf life. None of the others do. The other covenants do not have a shelf life, but the law of Moses had a shelf life and was written on it, and that's what it's saying. So this is the law of Moses' shelf life being described in Hebrews 9, verse 10. It says, until the time of reformation. What is the time of reformation? Now, we address this in lots of places, but the point I'm establishing is the shelf life of the law of Moses. It has an until, best before, you see? Not even best before. It's sell by. Sell by is a better phrase. Used by. That's it. You can tell I don't do the shopping. So it's used by. Okay? Used by the time of reformation. So let's look at what is that. So in verse 11 it says, but when Christ appeared as a high priest, now remember what we said, he cannot be that. He cannot be that under the law of Moses. But when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things that have come, then through the greater and more perfect tent, not made with hands, that is, not of this creation, he entered once for all into the holy place, taking not the blood of goats and calves, but his own blood, thus securing an eternal redemption. For if the sprinkling of defiled persons with the blood of goats and bulls and with the ashes of a heifer sanctifies for the purification of the flesh, how much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, purify your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? I've been reading from verses 11 to 14 of Hebrews 9. So what do we have in this? Firstly, Jesus has appeared as a high priest. That is illegal under the law of Moses. He cannot do that. Secondly, it says he's entered into the holy place. That is unlawful under the law of Moses. He could not enter into the earthly holy place. He couldn't go in there. He couldn't do that. That's for the priest to go in there, and for the high priest only to enter the Holy of Holies. And even then, only once a year. But this, in any case, is not talking about the earthly holy place. It's not talking about the earthly temple, the earthly holy place, the earthly Holy of Holies. It's not talking about that. He's talking here about the holy place that the temple is a type of or representation of. Because the temple itself and the tabernacle were a representation of what was real in heaven. There's a real equivalent. And into that Jesus entered. He entered into that in heaven at his death. It was then at his death that he did this. That he paid this price, you see. But the temple into which he entered was not the one on the earth in the temple. The holy place into which he entered was not that holy place. It says here, brackets, not made with hands, that is not of this creation. See? He makes it explicit. He didn't enter into that. We know that when Jesus died on the cross, he didn't go to the temple and offer a sacrifice of himself. Where did he do it? In the real place that the temple, the holy place, is a type of, a representation of, yeah? That's what he did. Now that he was able to do. Why? Because the law had been brought to an end. And now he was entitled to operate as a priest under the order of Melchizedek, which he was previously not permitted to do. You see, there was a change of law at that point.
Can I just say marvellous.
Yes.
In the temple that was on the earth, the curtain was raised.
The curtain was cut, yeah.
The Holy of Holies was...
That's right. That's right. The curtain was cut down. That's true. And that represented this. But the place into which Jesus entered was not that place. He entered into the real holy place. Okay, so in verse 15, we're still in Hebrews 9. It says in verse 15, therefore, he is the mediator of a new covenant. Now, in case we were in any doubt as to what is the new covenant, when does it begin, etc., this is it. This is the new covenant. In case anyone was thinking, yeah, but how do we know that what Jeremiah prophesied was fulfilled by what Jesus did? If anyone has any doubts on that score, they're removed by this verse, because it says he is the mediator of a new covenant. Okay? And it says then, so that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance. And this is a key line. Since a death has occurred which redeems them from the transgressions under the first covenant. Okay? Note, a death has occurred. Whose death? Jesus' death. Which redeems them from the transgressions under the first covenant. What's the first covenant? The law of Moses. So the death of Jesus redeems us from the transgressions that we committed under the first covenant. Okay? Now this is key. Verse 16. See, there's a lot to be found in Hebrews. A lot of people ignore the letter to the Hebrews because they find it complicated. But there's a lot of good stuff. Verse 16, watch this now. It says, for where a will is involved, the death of the one who made it must be established. Verse 17, for a will only takes effect at death, since it is not in force as long as the one who made it is alive. What is this talking about? Okay? And it goes on from verse 18 down to verse 22 talking about this. So what's it talking about? cut it off. John, what is it talking about? It's saying this is the essential point. The new covenant, do you understand that the new covenant is the New Testament? Do you know that the word covenant and testament are the same word? You know when you say, this is my last will and testament, on the top of a will? Testament and covenant mean the same thing. So you're making a covenant when you write your will. You're making a testament when you write your will. The New Testament, that which we call the New Testament, the new covenant, that which Jeremiah calls the new covenant, is effectively Jesus' will. Now, that to the extent that we inherit under his will. But his will only comes into operation at his death. So the new covenant comes into operation at the death of Jesus Christ because it is literally his will. Okay? And that's a useful and helpful way to look at the New Testament. It came into operation at his death. The new covenant, the New Testament came into operation then and changes the entire status of the situation. Because would you all agree, there is a difference between a man who is alive and has a will in his study drawer and a man who has died and the will is now at the solicitor's office being put into operation. Would you see a difference there? Now, when that will was in that man's study, in his drawer, and he was alive, it was not in operation. So the new covenant, when Jesus was alive, was in a drawer, not in operation. But when he died, the new covenant came out of the drawer and came into operation. Now, when the new covenant came into operation, the state of affairs which had previously prevailed ceased to apply. You can't be dead and having your will come into operation and your executors beginning to function. Your estate being wound up and dealt with, whilst at the same time you're alive on the earth. These are mutually exclusive states of affairs, aren't they? You can't have both, unless there's solicitor's negligence involved, or something like that. You can't have both. Anyway, read the rest of Hebrews to look at the rest of that. And then look in Hebrews 10, another good passage which helps to explain this. Hebrews 10, 1, it says, "For since the law has but a shadow of the good things to come, instead of the true form of these realities." See? That the law is a shadow of what's to come. That's one of its purposes. So the things that were being done, it says, it can never, by the same sacrifices which are continually offered year after year, make perfect those who draw near. So the law is described here as a shadow of what's to come. So the writer to the Hebrews is focusing upon the Levitical type of stuff, the priesthood and the sacrifices and so forth. All of that is a shadow of what's to come. Now, what is to come? The real person, the real sacrifice, the real one who's going to come. That's who's going to come. And when he comes, this is no longer applicable. So imagine you're standing outside a theatre and it's got a sign up and it says that some pop star or some film star is going to come. And he's going to come. And for weeks and weeks you've been looking at this poster each day as you go to work, and you see the poster and it says that, fill in the space, somebody that you consider to be famous is coming to the theatre. Okay? What is the poster about? It's a shadow of what's to come. It's got a picture there of him, the pop star, on the thing. It says his name, it says the date, it says he's coming, it says how long he's coming for. It's got his picture on. And you look at the poster each day. Now, what are you doing when you look at the poster? You're anticipating that he or that which is to come. Now, when the man comes, when the pop star comes, what would people think of you if he's inside the theatre singing and you're on the pavement outside looking at his poster? Do you see? And what would happen if during his concert you stood on the pavement outside gazing at his poster, as you have been doing for the last 4 weeks? Do you see? Everyone keeps interrupting my talk, don't they? The police and everybody. So, if you've been doing that for weeks, And then that's fine doing it for weeks, but what about doing it while the concert is on? Do you see the point? And when Jesus has come, the things that were a shadow are no longer applicable. The sacrifices in the temple which were pointing to him are no longer applicable now. Not only because the law is over, but because they're a shadow, they're a poster outside a theatre on a pavement, and you're not meant to stare at that when the pop star has come. Do you see? Okay. So I'm going to stop at that point and carry on in the next talk with some further issues on that same theme. But that's enough just for now.